You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Kia ora, my name is Jamie Hanton, and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Based in central Christchurch since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to achieve a higher level of professional and creative development and encourage a greater acknowledgement, understanding, and value of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate. Welcome to Episode 7 of Art Not Science, our first episode for 2020. In this episode, we continue with Part 2 of Hamster, Issue 5. Hamster is a serial magazine published by the Physics Room that responds to issues in contemporary art and publishing. Issue 5 focuses on themes of embodiment, performance, and relationships. For the first time in its publishing history, Issue 5 of Hamster has been produced simultaneously as an audiobook. In this episode, you can hear three of the authors reading their pieces. You can listen to the whole audiobook or read the magazine on the Physics Room website. Hard copies of the magazine will be available to pick up for free in our gallery space in the Art Centre when we reopen on the 28th of January. Part 2 starts off with Performing a Memory by Robin Murphy, followed by In Waves by Gemma Banks. And finally, Vanessa Krofsky reads their piece, Digital Cities.
Performing a Memory. Let's start with the experience of a memory, specifically an episodic memory. A scene from your life that can be remembered with the faint glimmer of something like re-experiencing the event. Let's go back to this morning, the moments between waking up and getting out of bed. Shut your eyes and try to enter that space. First, what are the concrete details? Did you wake up by yourself or with an alarm? Was there someone in the bed with you? How long did it take you to get up? Now the phenomenological, what did the sheets feel like? Were you groggy or alert? Did you remember your dreams? What was the quality of the light in the room? What was the temperature of the air on your skin? From the perspective of cognitive neuroscience, we know a fair amount about the biological processes at work when we generate memory and other thoughts, but a little about how these processes actually produce the subjective experience of thinking and remembering. The neuroscientist David Marr described this as, quote, trying to understand bird flight by studying only feathers. It just cannot be done, unquote. We know that thought requires the firing of neurons, that they set each other off in chains of action and inhibition, depending on the chemicals they pass to each other. We can observe synchronizing patterns of neuronal firing and the changes to the electromagnetic field at the scalp and the location of activity by tracking the changes in blood flow through fMRI. But as for how this electrical and chemical activity constitutes a thought, it's flight and we are still amongst the feathers. While it's easy to imagine transient thoughts that come and go as shifting patterns of activation, what about the thoughts that are able to be repeated in some way? What about memory? Early studies searched for the location of an n-gram, a functional unit of information thought to be stored in a discrete location in the brain, as if it were a filing cabinet or a hard drive. Researchers trained rats in mazes and then removed parts of their cortex, trying to find the key location without which the rats would forget how to run the maze. What they found, however, was that the memory was affected not by where the cortex was removed, but by how much. The greater the volume removed, no matter where from, the worse the rats performed in the maze. This led to the conclusion that the trace of any one memory, rather than being localized, is distributed throughout the brain, encoded in the changing strengths of the relationships between networks of neurons. At the algorithmic level, details of episodic memories are bound together within a cognitive diagram of their associations, called event models. The act of recalling these memories triggers a reperformance of the models that were active at the time of encoding, i.e. a restaging of the gestures and patterns that were active in processing the original experience. For example, one study using fMRI to track the location of activation in the brain had participants watch a film and then later recount its plot. They found that the pattern of activation as participants encoded each distinct scene was so similar to the pattern when they later narrated it that the part of the story being recounted could be predicted from the signature of activation alone. Beyond this, they ran fresh participants who listened to this narrated version of the film, and their pattern of activation was again so similar that the individual scenes of the film could be distinguished. What this means is that not only does remembering constitute a restaging of the original pattern, like a script for a performance, but our communication to others through language also acts like a transmission of the script. Look at the room around you. Try to catalog as much detail about the objects you can see and the spaces between them. Below the level of explicit perception, you are building a cognitive model of these relations. Look at the object which you're accessing this text from, whether it be paper, a phone, a laptop. If you're listening to the audiobook, move the object transmitting it so that it's within your reach. Next, close your eyes and try to hold the model you've built in your mind's eye. Keeping your eyes closed, reach out and touch the top left corner of your reading device. How accurate were you? Try this gesture again. Did you improve the second time? The process of building an event model is much like building a spatial model of the world, in that both involve binding of individual elements and the relations between them. These models are not discrete and faithful records, but rather they shape and are shaped by event schema, generalized models of how we expect events to go based on previous experience. Our experience of life is mediated by the many overlapping schema in which we maintain the relations between space, objects, other people, and ourselves. If cognition occurs as a pattern of activation, then we can picture it as gestural and performative. And if the act of remembering is the reperformance of a previous gesture, then we can think of memory as a biologically encoded script for such a performance. If we view memory in this way, then we can apply theoretical frameworks that have been built around performativity within other fields, such as performance art, a discipline which has meditated at length on the nature of bodies and space and in relation to each other. What does it mean to be performative? The trajectory of performance art that emerged in New York in the 1960s centered itself around the question of what performance is and does. First, performativity is not a quality that separates art from ordinary life, but rather is inherent in both. For example, the dancer Yvonne Rainer in works like The Mind is a Muscle from 1968, aptly titled for our conversation here, used choreography derived from pedestrian movements, in both senses of the word, ordinary, as well as literally mirroring the bustle and unchoreographed coordination of pedestrians on the street. Performers, together and individually, were instructed to move with a, quote, task or work-like movement with a factual quality, unquote, collaboratively building the work in their actions. For example, in Stairs, quote, Steve handstand, David grabs his legs while Y gets foam. Place, rolls down. D and S come front, push mat as D and S rejoin Y. Breast hold while she alone walks up and jumps. Unquote. For the feminist critic Amelia Jones, the use of the body as an art object constituted a, quote, dislocation or decentering of the Cartesian subject of modernism, unquote, a subject structured by clear demarcations between mind/body and self/other, by making visible the intersubjectivity between artist, art object, and viewer that is inherent within every encounter with art. Other artists, instead of inserting ordinary life into the realm of art, inserted art into the realm of ordinary life. Adrian Piper, for example, who stuffed a towel in her mouth and rode the subway and toured galleries with a handbag full of ketchup, violated the norms which ensure the smooth functioning of pedestrian life in order to upset her own visible invisibility as a white passing black woman. Using the body directly in the work brought with it all the messy specificities and context of the subject, as well as highlighting their position within matrices of power, aspects which modernist formalism sought to suppress. If we think of our own cognition in the same way, a lens of performativity allows us to frame it as embedded not only within the body as an evasion of Cartesian dualism, but also within social contexts shot through with racialized, gendered, and economic inequalities. And remember that both these contexts of the body and the body politic are in turn represented cognitively as schema, and as such are cognitively performed in ways which shape our behavior and thus our own influence back onto these contexts. A performative perspective on cognition can especially help us to understand what it means for cognition to be constructed in action. In defining performativity, Judith Butler quotes Nietzsche's assertion that the doer is constituted by the deed and applies this to her own argument about gender, in that gender identity is not essential, but rather something that is constituted by its own performance. Likewise, we could say that a memory is not a stable entity, remember the engram, but rather it is, quote, performatively constituted by the very expressions that are said to be its results, unquote. For the critic Peggy Phelan, performance art is a gesture in line with the linguist J.L. Austin's distinction between constitutive utterances, acts of speech that merely describe external reference in the world, and performative utterances, which are actions in and of themselves. Crucially, Austin's performative utterances are not subject to any binary positivism of being true or false. Recall the choreography of Rainer's Stairs. The performers move with a busy orderliness as they approach their tasks, which independently constitute small units of meaning, a jump, a somersault, a handstand, the execution of which depends on collaboration of the performers, which can be reconfigured endlessly and can repeat the same units of movement which only exist in their moment of execution and, even if repeated, are unique in every iteration. In this framework, thought is not abstract representation, but something as physical as a somersault. Shut your eyes again. Try to remember the gesture of reaching out in the dark. Don't physically move, but picture it as clearly as you can. Picture the trajectory of your reach, the pressure of contact on your hand. While you may not outwardly be repeating the movement, internally, your neurons are shadowing the earlier pattern of activation in order to simulate this previous experience. What does it mean for cognition to be performative? As with Jones's assertion, the major advantage of thinking of cognition as performative is that this position evades Cartesian dualism, which conceives of mind and body as separate, and which imagines subjects as able to function as rational observers divorced from corporeal reality. Despite this totalizing framework supposedly having been unraveled by post-structuralism, it has tended to linger and mutate rather than to die. In the field of cognitive science, Alan Jasanoff has argued that while we have ostensibly moved beyond the idea of a Cartesian subject and accepted that the mind emerges from the biological functions of the brain, the spirit of dualism persists by drawing a distinction between the brain and the rest of the body, mystifying the brain and its behavior. Beyond this, the hangover of Cartesian dualism, combined with 20th century cybernetics, has led to a tendency within cognitive science to view the brain as a disembodied computing organism, which receives input stimuli, performs a computation using abstract symbols, cognition, and generates outputs, action. In this model, information travels in a single direction, with no feedback between the levels, and with cognition happening within the sealed system of the brain. This framework has not gone unchallenged. In fact, as far back as 1916, the psychologist Margaret Floyd Washburn proposed the inextricability of bodily movement from mental life. More recently, there have emerged challenges that insist that cognition is inherently embodied as a routine bodily function, inactive, being constituted in action, as well as embedded in the wider physical and social context that the body inhabits, and as such, constituted in relation to others. These elements have all been played out and become well established in the trajectory of performance art. However, their emergence in the field of cognitive science has by no means become the dominant perspective, and often derided as an unscientifically vague fad. Remember, it doesn't last. Beyond locating thought and memory as embodied slash inactive slash embedded, a performative lens on cognition allows us to see that it also shares what, for Phelan, is the greatest strength of performance, its transience. For Phelan, the impermanence and unreproducible quality of performance means that it, quote, clogs the smooth machinery of reproductive representation necessary to the circulation of capital, unquote. This is again pertinent as the current resurgence of dualism comes in the form of transhumanist promises of radical life extension through uploading or technologically externalizing consciousness into a more permanent form, in what theorist Rossi Bredotti calls, quote, the transhumanist fantasy of escape from the finite materiality of the enfleshed self, unquote. The futility of technologically transcribing thought into some stable medium is the same futility that Phelan ascribes to attempts at performance documentation. For Phelan, writing especially relies on reproduction of the same, while at an ontological level performance is non-reproductive. Resisting reproducibility is for Phelan a strategy for resisting capitalist economies, which is why she advocates for resisting documentation. If we write a memory or thought, at best we can create a script for the reperformance in the minds of others or for ourselves. But as Phelan cautions, reperformances are only ever iterative, not replicative. Each restaging is unique in and of itself. Memory, our original attempt at transcribing the gestures that have constituted our lives, is fallible, itself just another performance that happens in an instant and then falls into nothing. Memory, our original attempt at transcribing the gestures that have constituted our lives, is fallible, itself just another performance that happens in an instant and then falls into nothing. The void of the past into which all things fall is the enduring reality that transhumanists try to scramble away from when they propose transcription of thought, memory, and consciousness itself into digital forms. Acceptance of the void, of the fleeting nature of all things, is for Phelan an evasion of the reproductive demands of capital, an escape hatch from its demands of permanence and profitable exchange.
You are listening to Art Not Science, a podcast presented by The Physics Room. That was Performing a Memory by Robin Murphy. Next is In Waves, read by Gemma Banks.
In Waves, Gemma Banks. The lining is on the loom. We carry a sewing machine into the studio. There are piles and piles of peach paper with fluorescent ink and perfume samples. The tiny space fills with the scent of jasmine, licorice, ink, and cotton. I place the first set of papers on the needle plate. The presser foot comes down and I begin to sew the pages together. The sky spins its magic and I feel its transcendent pull. I feel it in my palms, the colour as we slice, the grass on the field, the foiling of the windows. It stays with me when I leave, resting next to me as I sleep. Silent waves. Smiling as I walk beside him, he whispers into my ear, "These feelings are silk." Holding nothing, holding something. Waves quarrel amongst themselves, rising up and slamming down again. A tsunami of cells, tissue and marrow. It reminds me of when I was young and trusted monsters. He reaches out and grabs the knife, butters the bread and hands it to me. 3 days equal 50 in this world, but my eyes are fixed. It ripples through my chest, a compulsion held by many strands. I notice the way his shoulders hang as he walks into the room. He steps to the right as I step to the left. My pen torpedoes through the air. "I'm in love," I think. "Pass me the scalpel," he says. I walk into the studio and straight out again. The ocean roars, and I do too. Longing for more, always more. A note in the tarmac. The road is quiet. We circle each other. I begin to shiver. We watch the dawn rising, the printers hum. Ash falls from the sky, blurring my glasses and staining my scalp. Language dissolves on our faces like rain. A yellow mask enters the room. Digging into my spine, I split in two. Green square. I drop my bag on the floor. There are colours everywhere. Ink is in the air. Right up until the opening, my fingers thread. I tie narratives to memories, mechanical moments. The walls bleat, they're sick of the hollow glow thrust upon them. We watch horses, an evening passes. There are serpents in my dreams, and screens on skyscrapers. Crumbs in the keyboard, and 2% left in the wireless mouse. I wake with burnt arms. You wore sandals to work. As the weeks go on, an incision is made. Hands in, gripping my flesh. Together, foreign bodies wrench me apart. Forming into an image, a disconcerting image, a man at the front and a bookcase at the back. The moment I saw it, my heart undressed. Tell the stitching to stop. The bus breaks down and I start walking. The heat is linoleum, an impossible covering. I run back to the apartment and collapse in the cool. I sit at my desk hoping the goblins will drown. I open my drawer and pull out an orange. I position the knife and pierce the skin. 4 quarters. I sink my teeth deep into each center. I've made peace and I've remade peace. I stab poles in the snow and all I've learned is peace is fleeting. My eyesight rises and I begin to lift. Bodies of water. There are raised voices. The paperback I'm reading falls between my legs. 2 women are arguing on the pier. "It's always been like this," the younger one yells. The older one looks mortified, her face disfigured in shock. Haunted by holograms. Her mother tries to touch her, but the girl is already running. The walls are 20th century, the floors parquet. Sinking until born of bronze, I drip down to the mat. Pressing my hands to the floor, I marvel in the wake of loss. I dive in red. I have been here before, but then again I haven't. Altered landmarks. Where there was a puddle, there is now an ocean. Letting go, the dust, my lungs, the feeble fall. Beyond the walls, the doors, the hallways, there is a waterfall, and the waterfall is falling, falling, falling.
You're listening to Art, Not Science, a podcast presented by The Physics Room. That was In Waves by Gemma Banks. Next up is Vanessa Krofsky's Digital Cities.
Digital Cities.
Images is of writing on a piece of A4 paper in Sharpie. Image reads, toot if you're anxious.
Can I join a 12-step meeting for inbox avoidance? It feels slightly ironic to be undertaking a physical residency at the Physics Room when my performance is digital. You can be online everywhere and anywhere. Its reach stretches as far and broad as a Wi-Fi signal. But as divorced from the physical that the World Wide Web might seem, the internet still occupies real architecture. It exists in our concretely occurring lives through modems, antenna, and fiber optic veins laying deep on the seafloor. It exists in real networks of friends, shared activities like tennis or swimming. Online coordinates are usually matched to offline behaviors or vice versa. Even if we were to label it all a big mistake and delete the internet from our human browser history, we still couldn't change how it has affected our headspace. My head is uploaded to the cloud, but in reality I'm in Ōtautahi. In Christchurch, although I know very few people, I have plenty of companions to perform for and to. Hamish takes photographs and makes sure I always have someone to eat dinner with. I go to yoga with Rhea and Michelle, meet Kim from Pukori Productions, drink coffee at the Physics Room HQ, and laugh at Jamie holding up a big sign for me that he doesn't want posted publicly. I perform to different audiences, to the gathered group of acquaintances picking at grapes, to the select and registered attendees of a workshop, to the infinite microcosm of likes and views online, to the senders and recipients of emails, to strangers on the street. To be on social media is to be a mime in a maze of mirrors. You're the performer you're being performed to, you're watching a performance, you're in the car waiting for the event to end. I've had inbox anxiety for a long time. The majority of my work connects to being online and I don't know how to separate myself from it cleanly. I'm so online. I am somebody out of an episode of Hoarders, shameful, in denial, and paralyzed by a crippling inability to deal with the volume of content around me. The inbox is a place of economy and precarity, scarcity, overwhelm, and deficit. We're facing a genuine loneliness epidemic. It's also a place where memes exist, where I sustain the friendships unable/too tired to migrate offline. How do we throw out the garbage and keep the good content? I'm the baby. The internet is my bathwater. How is other people, or at least being constantly accessible to them? Intimacy feels as bright as the sun. I can't look at it directly. I have to manage it through laptop screens and drunken phone DMs. My dismal Tinder date from Tamaki keeps texting. I get separation anxiety when I plug my phone into a wall charger. I remember hearing a friend use the phrase, it's too admin, to justify why they weren't going out that evening. I don't go on dating apps because it is frightening for 70 dudes to have access to you. Making a rain dance to SMS notifications. Burying my phone in quicksand. A watch pot never boils, but my phone still rings. I definitely saw your messages and they made me feel sick inside. Wins is the only person who sends me letters anymore, mostly saying that I owe them money. Daily phone usage report for the last 5 days, 10th October 2019 to 15th October 2019. 3 hours 58 minutes, 80 unlocks. 2 hours 13 minutes, 30 unlocks. 3 hours 19 minutes, 58 unlocks. 3 hours 55 minutes, 113 unlocks. 4 hours 13 minutes, 94 unlocks. Inbox audit. 87 unread conversations on Facebook Messenger since 1st January 2019. 99 plus WhatsApp notifications. 147 unread emails in my priority inbox. 17,571 total unopened emails. 27 unopened texts. 15 recent DMs on Instagram. 10 unopened message requests on Instagram. 19 unopened message requests on Facebook. 4 unread threads on Slack. 6 unread messages on Twitter, 3 other social media accounts, 3 other email addresses.
The writer confirms that this information holds true at the time of 12:52 p.m, 15th October 2019, and that all unopened messages remain unreplied to.
Image is of an email attachment on Monday, 16th September 2019 at 9:16 p.m. Rosabel Tan, rosabel@gmail.com, wrote, and then the person has sent an image of six monks in grey clothing on a roller coaster. The caption reads, "Baby monks on vacation."
I want to find out how we feel about the internet. How can we understand the ways we interact online through physically embodying these social states? Part of my performance is moonlighting as the physics room online. I am trying to be antagonistic and uninstitutional, but also I hope people think I am funny and get what I am doing. I have minimal employment fealty to this account, but I still hold some baseline pride when it comes to taking selfies. People who I don't know reply to my stories, friends and strangers email me whilst in Monica. Real life connections follow me over separate social media accounts, @deathbypdf, @physicsroom, . It feels like getting married and your family's intermingling. Should I take Room as my new last name? The other part of my residency is offline, through public performance and workshopping. For my public performance, I sit in a corner of the Christchurch CBD and try to get people to talk to me. It is much harder to do this outside of a phone screen. Trying to talk to others in broad daylight as you occupy a street corner doesn't feel friendly anymore. It feels weird and unsafe. Either I want attention or just to be invisible. Being online is a two-way highway. I manage to find some lone souls on the street willing to chat, but the rest ignore my increasingly desperate eye contact. Face-to-face interaction takes us out of our bubble. It reminds me that we have decided what forms a collective, a family, a neighborhood, and a city. We don't really interact with the other much anymore, and it's much easier for us to be vulnerable in cyberspace.
Two images are presented side by side. The first is a portrait of the writer holding up a sign. The sign is on an A3 piece of paper in an office setting. It reads, "Send nudes at hamster@physicsroom.co.nz. The second image is of the writer sitting outside a house on a street with lots of signs next to her. She looks bored. Caption reads, "Really great idea to run a public performance about talking to people when you fucking hate talking to people."
For the workshop, participants and I test out how we can present our online selves offline. Part of this activity is seeing what an IRL inbox might feel like. Footnote, I did forget that letterboxes exist. Those who partake respond to a variety of questions, mimicking the range of messages one might receive within a day. Spam, DMs about opportunities for exposure, benign family texts, passive-aggressive hate mail, and vulnerable confessions. Each person's response is sealed in an envelope, shuffled like playing cards, and read aloud by allocated speakers. The slowness of pace, of having to physically open an envelope, translate a person's handwriting, then read it aloud, means that the information is processed in a way that would never occur naturally online. It makes me wish for the slowness of dial-up internet.
Two images are presented next to each other. The first is of two participants at the workshop who are holding phones up to their mouths. The second is an A4 piece of paper that has been scanned in with handwriting. It reads, "Get off your mile high ground, you silly bitch. You just as effed up as the rest of us."
Inbox anxiety is the sickness of digital dystopianism. Understanding our anxieties can help us figure out how to process our relationship to an object or situation. To be online is to be controlled by or connected to a computer, but we also built computers. We made institutions. We even made self-checkouts at supermarkets. Structures and systems, they're all made up of us, unsure and doing our best. Our lives still run on human schedule. I'm not saying this to diminish the current power imbalance that it feels like big data companies have over us, or to naively assume that we have been given equal footing. I just want to remind a person that everything is rooted in that which once looked like soil. There is something so sincere about spam. It just wants you to follow its lead. It reminds me of how clumsily we are tethered to one another. Even in the digital hellscape, we are pulled into each other's orbits, for better or for worse. There is an oscillating tension held between intimacy and isolation, one that digital technology exacerbates. The masks which suffocate us also enable us to coexist in mutual space without the threat of social rejection. We live in an era of shifting boundaries. Public and private, URL and IRL, work and play, identity and community. Human connection has been our lifeline above all. It's what keeps us on the web. It's why we got catfished by capitalism. It's the reason we swim through inboxes full of porn, bios, headshots, and bots to reach each other. This digital landscape is our city, full of neighbors, transparent interfaces, walls, and windows. Not all of us get along. Not all of us know each other. The soil is turbulent and our social positions unstable, but perhaps that was always the case.
Bibliography. Number 1. Shaina Ali, What You Need to Know About the Loneliness Epidemic. Psychology Today. Last modified July 12, 2018. Number 2. Greg Goldbach, Anti-Social Media, Anxious Labor in the Digital Economy. New York, NYU Press, 2018.
Thank you for listening to Episode 7 of Art Not Science. Tune in next month to hear the artist talk from our first exhibition of the year, The Shouting Valley, which opens on Tuesday, 28th January at 5:30 p.m. Please join us for the opening if you're in Ōtautahi. Mā te wā!
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, Resine Paints, and the Crater Rim.